Welcome. The events of 1492, the catastrophic expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, and their dispersion over the face of the earth, and the beginnings of redemption with the return of a group of pietists, scholars, and saints in the Palestinian village of Safed at the top of the Galilee near Lake Tiberias, all of these things did not change the face of the Kabbalah. They changed its melodic line, perhaps, something on the order of a transposition of what was written in major mode to minor key, perhaps changing the rhythms from something more lively to something more lethargic, more triste, more sad. The raw materials for Isaac Luria's reconstruction of the Theosophic Kabbalah after 1492 were all there. But it was his imaginative genius, his creativity, his imagination, which refashioned and recast his explanation for why the catastrophe had occurred, what needed to be done to repair and rectify it all, and who would benefit by it. As a good Kabbalist, Luria and his disciples knew that what was at stake was not merely socio-political events, not merely what was going on in the outside, ordinary, external world, but also something going on within the very depths of God, having learned from the classics of Jewish mysticism that all of reality is one unified, recapitulating set of mirrors, reflecting one another and reflecting the great macrocosm of God's infinite, productive, creative, dynamic inner being. If there was catastrophe and displacement in the outer world in history, that pointed to some sort of a catastrophe and fracturing within the divine world as well. The main lines of the Lurianic myth are threefold, three major concepts which he developed and pressed on his students, who in turn disseminated these ideas to Jewish communities everywhere. According to Luria's imaginative mythological reconstruction of how things came to be the way they are, in the beginning there was only Ein Sof, pure divinity, like the ocean, calm, containing all things, not like the ocean. To liken divinity before things happened would be to belittle it, to diminish it. In the beginning there was only the divine, the very deepest structures of reality in its most pristine form. In order that there be anything else, the first act that divinity needed to do was to create space for that which was other than divinity in its pristine, undifferentiated, harmonious whole. That first act then of creating a creative space in Luria's mythology is known as Tzimtzum, which is a paradoxical term, meaning both to concentrate energy in one place or to contract, to pull away. The first thing that Ein Sof, divinity, reality in its pristine, undifferentiated unity did was to withdraw into itself, concentrating itself in order to create a vacuum, an empty workspace. The interpreters differ as to how complete that empty space was. Was it totally bereft of divine presence, or were there shards of the divinity there, on the German Hasidic principle that there can't be any place in which there is no divinity? Some interpreters said it was totally bereft of the divine. It was anti-divine. Other commentators said that the working space created by Ein Sof and Tzimtzum left a residue of the divine presence, otherwise there couldn't have been the empty space to begin with. In any case, the first act was Tzimtzum, creating the possibility for that which was other than the undifferentiated, pristine unity of God's being. Having created this empty space, according to the Lurianic myth, Ein Sof then produced a second act, in which it gathered out of itself the potentiality for catastrophe, for evil, For long before the world ever came to be, according to one interpretation of the Lurianic story, Ein Sof was prompted into doing the act of Tzimtzum in order to undergo a process of catharsis. Reality, God in its origins, was seeking to free reality of the potential evolution of evil, of the Sitra Achra, of the dark side. The empty space created by Tzimtzum was the place where all of these evil potentials would be sent. God would then withdraw his existing power from these forces of evil, these potential seeds, and they would evaporate, dry up, as if they were balloons being pricked, letting the air revert to the atmosphere, leaving the shards of the balloon, the outside, shrivel and die. So act number two, after the creation of a space for the ungodly by Tzimtzum, the seeds of potential evil were gathered up and sent into this empty space. And according to all Kabbalistic principles, nothing contains unless it has a container. And so the seeds of potential evil were sent out in, so to speak, vessels, kelim, that which would hold them, give them their identity, their differentiation from Ein Sof. And after this great experiment of sending out the seeds of potential evil from within itself, reality was hoping to withdraw its positive existence and let evil disappear before it ever had a chance to emerge. But evil being evil, and Ein Sof apparently knowing what eventually would happen, things went awry. There was a primal catastrophe. Something had happened in the process by which the divine had hoped to rid itself of evil. The vessels containing the potential for evil broke, shattered. There was destruction. What should have been organized and well run fell apart, like a laboratory test tube crashing to the floor, smashing itself to pieces, spreading the contents all over, interlocked with shards of broken glass. In Luria's mythological terms, this was the Shvirat HaKelim, the inability of the vessels to hold the forces of evil long enough for God to destroy them before they could take on life. But it didn't work. And Ein Sof, responding to this catastrophe, now had the job of gathering up the shattered, broken pieces of the vessels, containing elements of the seeds of evil within it, and start the experiment all over again. Things needed to be fixed. And this would be the great act of reparation, the third main stage of the Lurianic myth, explaining why things have gotten as bad as they are. This would be the stage of tikkun, rectification, fixing, healing, repairing, putting those vessels back together again in order that the original experiment, the original catharsis of evil would be undone. Apparently, according to the myth, the act of tikkun almost occurred. It almost was done. But evil being as recalcitrant and as deeply embedded in reality as it is, it didn't work. And the catastrophe repeated itself. There was another, yet another act of Shvirat HaKelim. After the reparation by God, the vessels broke again, creating more shards, more scattered pieces of God's original reality, intermixed with the potential seeds for evil. One Shvirat HaKelim, one breaking of the vessels, followed by another act of tikkun, of repair, followed by another, yet another, breaking of the vessels, and by another act of tikkun. And in each telling of the Lurianic myth, the number of times and the stages of the breaking of vessels, the revolt of evil against reality itself, the unwillingness of evil to yield to its own extirpation, again and again and again, world after world, breaking of the vessels, an attempt to rectify, and falling short at the last moment. According to the Lurianic myth, then, unlike the Zohar, for which evil was a necessary byproduct of the world, evil being likened unto the vessel that holds the wine or the perfume, evil being likened unto the unfortunate necessity that if a composer wants to make music, then the inspiration needs to be confined into musical notes, notes sitting like prisoners behind the bars of the staff. That's just the way it has to be, according to the Zohar. There can't be birth without placenta. Evil is a necessary byproduct. But in the radical reading of the Lurianic myth, it wasn't evil which was a byproduct of creation, the result of the first sin by Adam and Eve in the garden. It was evil which itself precipitated creation. It was evil itself which moved God to even begin the act of creating anything other than itself. Evil is not the byproduct for the Lurianic myth. Evil is the very prod that makes things happen, and happen catastrophically. One world after another, one world after another, broken vessels, as if according to that lovely little child's rhyme that you remember, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall one day, and Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, and all the king's horses and all the king's men were never able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. In a Kabbalistic reading of that nursery rhyme, reality, the divinity, is the great egg itself, Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty perched itself precariously on a wall only because Humpty Dumpty was trying to accomplish something greater. But reality can't be defied, even by God himself. The Kabbalists were not unwilling to go so far as to suggest that God in his own powers is somehow limited, restricted, confined, in need of tremendous help from the outside, if not from within. God himself, all the king's horses, and all the king's men, thinking symbolically with the Zohar, were unable to make the repairs necessary to return the world to its original pristine unity, but this time rid of the possibility that evil would emerge. It didn't work. Stage after stage of catastrophe, long before there was history, long before the physical universe had existed, deep within the depths of the divinity itself, more and more, again and again, breaking of vessels, each of the vessels carrying a shard, and within each shard, a lining of the divine goodness, intermixed, broken, unable to be put back together again. The penultimate attempt by God, by Ein Sof, to fix it all, after things had devolved and broken into more and more pieces, was to create a spiritual Garden of Eden and a spiritual Adam and Eve. And all that the spiritual Adam and Eve would have to do in that spiritual Garden of Eden would be to obey God's law, and in obeying the law, the final act of tikkun, of reparation, would be accomplished. Everything was perched, ready, at the 11th hour, for the final tikkun by spiritual Adam and spiritual Eve in the Garden of Eden. But the forces of evil, too, had reached a certain level of development where there was a spiritual force of evil on a par with the spiritual Adam and Eve. That spiritual representative of the forces of evil, the serpent. And what happened in the spiritual Garden of Eden to the spiritual Adam and Eve, because of the provocation of the spiritual serpent, was yet another reenactment of rebellion, of Shvirat HaKelim. The story is well known. The antecedents of our physical ancestors, Adam and Eve, sinned, recapitulating the act of the breaking of the vessels, and the world fell into even more disarray. God's pieces even more shattered, destroyed, disunited, broken. And the universe fell from its spiritual reality as if a frozen into frozen, congealed form of the physical world in which we know now. Physical bodies housing souls. Hard, coarse, undivine shells covering all things. Nuts with hard shells. Souls with bodies. Music with mathematically defined notes and rhythms. All things being imprisoned. It's almost as if there were a recovery of the old Platonic notion that the soul is imprisoned in the body and yearns to break free. There are many analogies to be found between some of the old Platonic myths and some of these other stories that Luria tells, many of them to be found in the body of literature from antiquity known under the umbrella term Gnosticism. Gnosticism in antiquity, too, was a set of myths explaining why the soul has to suffer the fate of falling into this world, of being a body, of being a stranger and an alien in a physical universe apart from its spiritual light, separated from its kin above, separated from its kindred souls below. It's as if Luria and his disciples spontaneously reinvented, if there weren't a question of reproducing, the ancient Gnostic myths that explain reality in the human predicament and the divine predicament in terms of catastrophe. And so, after spiritual Adam and Eve became the physical Adam and Eve, the process of tikkun was undertaken again. This time it would unfold according to the historical narrative told in the Bible. The Jewish people would eventually have to be created. The Torah and its laws would have to take earthly form. Not the Torah as it exists within God, but the Torah as it exists at this fallen level, addressing physical people. The Torah being, as the Kabbalah teaches, not identical with the book in our possession now, but being merely one form that divinity can take as it inlibrates itself rather than incarnates itself in the form of books and scrolls. The final tikkun would rest in the hands of the Jewish people, that embodiment of the good forces within God. If they obey the law, if they defeat the forces of evil, then the tikkun will be effected. The king's men and the king's horses in the form of Israel would indeed be able to repair the broken shells. The shards would be put back together, and the divine sparks which had fallen so far from their origin, released from the prison of the klipot, of the shells, would ascend, reuniting with all of the other sparks of the divine world on their way back to the reunification and restoration of the original harmony of divine being. Except this time in restoration, there'd be no more possibility for evil to emerge. The goal of Lurianic Kabbalah was to uplift the fallen sparks. Sparks being that soul, that inner spirit, anticipated in some way, reading earlier Jewish mysticism in the light of Lurianic myth, those sparks would be the souls of the angels and of the various human beings that the German Hasidim had talked about. The uplifting of the sparks, the divine presence which resides in the depths of all things, as the Zohar taught us. As Nachmanides says, all things in the world are allusions to God because in some sense, within the depths of all things, is a recapitulation and a substantiation of the divine itself. To uplift the sparks means to raise the spirits back to the world from which they had fallen, perfecting it, or in a religious language borrowed from the rabbis but charged with new meaning, God would be made one again. In garden variety rabbinic Judaism, it was a declaration of faith. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. It was a statement of fact. But after being transformed in medieval Kabbalah by its theosophic and theurgic ideas, that call of the Jewish people, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, was not a description of a present reality, but it was a formula by which the unity would be made. That is exactly what the Zohar was saying again and again and again. The building up of the word, the restoring to the maiden, the lover, her full form. God would be made one. The sparks would be uplifted. Evil would disappear. The world would revert to an improved, perfect, undifferentiated unity. The world and God would be one again. Uplifting the sparks meant recognizing that all things contain sparks and that all things were sparks imprisoned in shells. Luria, in his ascetic turn, and his disciples decided or felt that the way to battle evil, to undo Sitra Achra, was in many ways to follow the precedence of the German pietists. Lead a rigorous ascetic life. Destroy, weaken the body, destroy, weaken the shells, identifying the souls within and allowing the spirits to rise up. Tzimtzum, contraction, Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, and tikkun, rectification, by means of the uplifting of sparks, releasing them from their imprisonment, would mean redemption. It would mean putting things back where they belonged. This would be the Messianic era, and it would be done by all of the agents of the Messiah, the Jewish people, who would follow the proper praxis, understanding exactly what it was to live not on behalf of human pleasure or necessity, but living on behalf of the divinity which had undergone such pain. A later Hasidic tradition from the 19th century puts this notion, this Lurianic notion, succinctly and very powerfully. Unlike normal religion, which says that people ought to request of God the fulfillment of human needs, the Kabbalists realized that the greatest needs of all were those of God. And therefore, as the Hasidic tradition puts it, in a revolutionary, audacious formulation that runs counter to ordinary, regular religiosity in which human beings are only out for themselves, the Hasidim, speaking for the Kabbalists, said, all of man's prayers should be for the sake of the Shekhinah, the feminine within God. It is her needs who need to be taken into account in prayer. Because another code, symbolic name for the Shekhinah, is prayer. That's one of God's names. And that's what one should be thinking about when one prays. Not oneself, but the needs of the divine. For each of man's needs is only a reflection of some lack in the divine itself. If there's something missing in the human being, that's a microcosmic reflection of something missing and deficient in the divine world. Hence, people should pray for her fulfillment, for God's fulfillment, for the Shekhinah's fulfillment, not merely his own. As man brings oneness to the upper worlds and restores that which is lacking above, his own needs too will be fulfilled, but as a byproduct. Primarily, the goal of religious life was to pray and act on God's behalf, which was the ultimate consummation, the capstone of the theosophical notion of theurgy, that what human beings do have everything to do with God's own well-being. These were the ideas that Isaac Luria's disciples disseminated. Obviously, there were differences of opinions. The way that I've presented the Lurianic myth, it's very dualistic. There's a world of the godly and a world of the ungodly, a Manichaean dualism, and human beings are caught between the two and are the battleground between forces of materiality and forces of spirit, far removed from the pantheistic optimism of the Zohar. There were other interpreters of Luria who softened the dualism, who maintained the basic panentheistic and pantheistic enthusiasm of the Zohar by saying that Luria was not trying to juxtapose the godly spirit with ungodly or anti-godly body, but he had mixed the two realms together. In either case, The Lurianic myth and its basic categories of Tzimtzum, Shvirat HaKelim, catastrophe, and Tikkun became the bywords of Jewish mysticism and of Jewish communities wherever the propaganda reached. The Messianic age would be reached if the law was properly observed, if ascetic practices were rigidly done, if the spirits were identified and the sparks uplifted, if everybody worked, it could be done. If you didn't work for the solution of the problem, then you were part of the problem itself. Jews were called upon to dedicate all of their lives and energy to the uplifting of sparks, ushering in the Messianic era, which had been so beautifully described in that hymn. The Messianic era that would bring the redemption of the Jewish people by reunifying it with its land, rebuilding the stones, reunifying the stones of the temple with one another, reunifying all peoples to their proper places, reunifying God with himself, the bride with the groom, on all of the interlocked levels of reality. That would be the Messianic era of Tikkun, of redemption. It would be changing the world. The Messianic era would be ushered in. The forces of evil would be vanquished. One of the disciples of these Lurianic ideas was a 17th century Jew by the name of Shabtai Tzvi. A young man, persecuted by his own sense of inadequacy, driven by his own religious zeal, filled with passion for the Lurianic messianic project, was a strange sort of lad, did many sorts of things. In his moments of enthusiasm, he sometimes even perpetuated certain sins. And then he would fall into fits of depression, where he would regret having done what he did. This psychological state was interpreted for him by his teachers and by the ones who framed his own self-understanding, by Nathan of Gaza, his psychotherapist, as merely the working out of the drama of the Messianic era, in which all things, even evil things, have an inner divine spark, a redemptive value. In the grand scheme of the Kabbalah, evil and good are not absolute terms, but they are relative. And in some sense, Shabtai was told, his evil deeds were deeds of redemptive holiness. Trained and groomed for his paradoxical messianic role in the 17th century, Shabtai took it upon himself to begin the messianic act of redemption by converting the Sultan in Constantinople to Judaism. And so he marched triumphantly to the capital of the Ottoman Empire. Of course, we know the outcome of the story. Shabtai did not convince the Sultan to convert to Judaism and his followers to leave Islam to become Jews. Shabtai was given a choice. You can maintain your messianic pretensions and leave your head on the floor, or you can join us and save yourself. Paradoxically fulfilling earlier patterns in his life, Shabtai, whom everybody knew about by this time, not only Jews but non-Jews, had heard the story of this new Jewish Messiah who in the middle of the 17th century would usher in the true Messianic era. Everybody was ready for the last moment's redemption. And then news reached everyone who had been dressed up for the party, the Messianic party, that it was all over. Shabtai, the supposed Messiah, became a Muslim. He converted. Mostly everybody knew that that meant he wasn't the Messiah. But those who were trained in the paradoxical turns of thought of the Kabbalah knew better. This was merely an appearance. And Jewish mysticism had taught people for centuries not to be confused by appearance. The outer act of conversion, this ultimate act of apostasy, of betrayal of the Jewish people only on the surface looked like it was a betrayal of the Messianic idea. They understood that only by converting, by going over to the other side, could the Messiah fight evil on its own terms. This was a descent into the pit of reality in order to heal it from within. Paradoxical. That's the way messiahs work. They perform evil acts in order to do a holy end. Some messiahs are said to have died in order to conquer life. Some messiahs are said to have suffered in order to relieve others of their suffering. Shabtai, too, as another Jewish messiah, paradoxically created another mystically informed messianic movement. Paradoxical, strange. Fed by the ideology of the holiness of sin, which insisted in good religious fashion that there must be divine presence in everything, even in an apparent act of evil. And when one thinks about it, hasn't that been the story of Jewish redemption from the very beginning? Haven't the messianic forces in Judaism always worked their way out in strange, mysterious ways? Hasn't it always been an apparent act of breaking the law, or of undoing the law, that brought redemption? We know the story of Queen Esther, who paraded as something other than she was from the biblical book of Esther, in order to be in the right place and in the right time to save the Jewish people. She too hid her identity. But many Jews in the 17th century didn't have to go back to the Bible to find examples of paradoxical ways in which people hid their true identities in order to accomplish the greater goal of redemption. Recall all those Jews who were Muranos, the ones who had led an inner existence as Jews and an outer existence as Christians. They too knew what it meant to be one thing on the inside, something quite other on the out, and to live in that dialectical tension and confusion, knowing that their hearts were pure, even if their deeds may have looked to the unsuspecting or the unbelieving or the unfaithful as strange. Shabtai Tzvi was celebrated by his followers as the paradoxical Messiah. He either had accomplished the messianic act, and whether you knew it or not, the world had been redeemed, and business was no longer as usual, that what had been once forbidden was now permitted, and what was once forbidden was now permitted, that the Torah as we had it had been transformed in the messianic age, and that new revolutionary paradoxical behavior was the call. These were the radical Sabbateans, the ones who gloried in telling the details of Shabtai's life, writing the gospel, each gesture, each movement that he had made being a significant detail in the messianic biography of redemption. Not long after, in Eastern Europe, there was another aftermath of these Lurianic messianic ideas. Shabtai, who had told people that he was the Messiah, and who had established strange ways of changing the world, set the ideological scene, if not the personal scene, for a revivalist Jewish movement in Eastern Europe, which came to be known as Hasidism. From the outside, and as they're known to us now, the Hasidim don't seem to be very revolutionary. They certainly don't seem to have anything to do with paradoxes of evil doing and of sinning in the name of great stuff. They seem to be quite ultra-Orthodox, punctilious, and arch-conservative, hardly mystical at all. But close research at the ideas and basic foundations of the Hasidic movement show how deep its debt is to Lurianic ideas and to Sabbatean notions which celebrated the personality of the redeeming figure. But it was Sabbateanism with a difference in the Hasidic movement. It was no longer the grandiose redemption of the whole world that the Hasidim wanted to bring. They wanted to uplift sparks, that's for sure. They wanted all of human life to be devoted to the needs of God rather than to the human ones. But they no longer were thinking about a cosmic tikkun. They weren't going to fix the whole world. They weren't going to be messianic in the Sabbatean or Lurianic way. They wouldn't be ascetics, nor would they be antinomians, either performing evil deeds or waiting for permission finally to live differently. But they nonetheless believed in redemption. They nonetheless believed in the uplifting of sparks. They nonetheless respected the power of their religious leaders, the tzaddik, who in some ways as a messiah would redeem, but the area of redemption would no longer be the world. The area of redemption would now be the individual members of his community. Redemption was the personal, the human, the everyday. There would be no more messiah, at least as Hasidism, an outgrowth of Lurianic Kabbalah, developed. There's a tradition in early Hasidism which captures what Gershom Scholem has described as the neutralization of the messianic element in Hasidic life. This is a tradition cited in the name of a Rabbi Bunam. Before the Messiah will come, there will be rabbis without Torah, Hasidim without Hasidism, rich men without riches, summers without heat, winters without cold, and grain stalks without grain. This would be a reversion to pre-Lurianic, pre-Messianic expectations about how the world would be fixed. Yes, have faith that the Messiah will come, but don't hold your breath. We'll know that the Messiah is coming when such paradoxical things happen as cows giving chocolate milk, as my grandmother used to say. Or there'll be summers without heat, winters without cold. Yes, say the Hasidim, the Messiah will come. The great tikkun, the great restoration will occur. But in the time being, what needs to be taken care of are the uplifting of the sparks of the fallen souls of Israel. That was to be the main concern. God, the world of the Sefirot, the deep symbolism, all more or less faded into what has been described as a democratization of Kabbalistic theosophy. Like everything else in modern times, the Hasidim would turn their attention to the fate and destiny of the souls of the followers. Hasidism and their leaders, the tzaddikim, apparently flourished because, unlike the traditional leadership of the Jewish community in the 18th and 19th century in Poland, these were leaders who were charged with the responsibility of mediating between God and their people. It was wonderful if they were scholars, but more important, if they knew how to redeem, if they knew how to teach, if they knew how to translate the abstract metaphysics of Kabbalah into a pattern of life that made it bearable and livable. The Hasidim reached back to the older humanistic traditions of people like Abraham Abulafia, and they reached back to the translation of Kabbalah into ethics, which had developed throughout the Middle Ages, but in particular in the 16th century. For example, the Kabbalists had taught, and the Hasidim learned to imitate the translation, the abstract idea of God's nothingness. Out of the God who is all things and nothing in particular came the ethical notion of equal treatment of all. According to an ancient 16th century text that was much favored by the Hasidim, all people can achieve a state of divine nothingness. Not by undergoing the rigorous discipline of Abulafia, not by the technical techniques developed by the German Hasidim for perceiving God, nor even through the very arcane, difficult exercises that a Kabbalist would need to go through to understand the unfolding of the Sefirot, one from the other. Deep meditation. That wasn't the way to achieve divine nothingness. In order for human beings to imitate God and be nothing, they need to treat all people as if they themselves were nothing, making no distinction. Or as the text said, nothing is the root, and from this root grow humility and lowliness. Just as the uppermost of all the Sefirot generously bestows on all of reality its riches, so too should the human being behave as if the human being were the great divine sphere of nothing. Free to rich and poor alike, regarding oneself as no greater than his fellow man, but feeling non-existent before him. It's the ideal of humility. This is not the sort of non-existence that Abulafia was preaching, feeling as if you were dying to the world and living in the heavens above. This was a democratic, ethicized nothingness. It was to say that my ego shouldn't stand in the way of my treating all other people like me. And in the great Kabbalistic notions of unity, the Kabbalists taught, by following the path of nothingness, by doing away with my sense of myself, in this way, any man and his fellow are integrated into one another. For the category of nothing combines a thing and its opposite. And so, we have three forms of Lurianic redemption. We have the asceticism of Luria and his disciples, all of whom who are working to uplift the sparks to usher in the Messianic era. We have the antinomian paradoxical Sabbateans who are uplifting sparks through the paradoxical deeds of evil. And we have the Hasidim who are taking care of one another, leaving their lives in the hands of their gifted, charmed tzaddikim. There's a verse in Psalms 55:18 which could well be said by all Kabbalists and Lurianic mystics, Sabbateans, and Hasidim. Psalms 55:18, He will deliver my soul in safety from the battle that I wage, for many are arrayed against me. The Zohar may have understood all of this as God's conversation with himself, the feminine saying that he, my lover, will save me for the many forces that are arrayed against me. For the Sabbateans, he will deliver my soul in safety, is the statement said by Israel or by God, referring to the Messiah, Shabtai. Shabtai will redeem my soul, says God, from the battle that I wage, for many are arrayed against me. Or the Hasidim could say it of their religious leaders, the Tzaddik. He won't save the world, but my Tzaddik can save me. He will deliver my soul in safety from the battle that I wage, the everyday battle of everyday life, for many are arrayed against me. From the heights of Kabbalistic metaphysics to the perverse messianism of the Sabbatean movement, to the humanistic pastoral care of the tzaddik for his flock, we have one verse that seems to capture it all. He will deliver my soul in safety from the battle that I wage. Could mean something metaphysical and theosophical, or it could mean something very down to earth and very human. For many are arrayed against me. We can understand that metaphysically as the great forces of Sitra Achra, the metaphysical realm of evil, or the many who are arrayed against me may be the daily travails of life that can only be cured in the communal confines of the tightly bound Hasidic movement, or in the embrace of a paradoxical Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. Thank you.